So, good morning, everybody. Welcome. Shabbat Shalom. Thank you all for coming, for being here, and especially to you, Stephen. You are a dear Dharma friend. You are a dear Dharma teacher and inspiration. For those of us who do not know you that well, Stephen has written many books, one of which, Buddhism Without Beliefs, was translated into Hebrew by Eran and myself. And he is the founder of Bodhi College and also one of the founders of the Secular Buddhist Network. And last week, Stephen, you reached out and wrote to ask if there is anything at all I can do to help. And I shared with you some of what we've been going through over the last 3 weeks. It's been a tsunami of emotions, wave after wave. The unimaginable horror, the shock, the confusion, the tragedy, the loss, the sorrow, heartbreak, and radical uncertainty, fear for our very existence, shaken to our core. And at the same time, amazing shows of courage, creativity, and solidarity. And now you are here with us, and I just want to express my deep thanks and appreciation for your care, your support, and your generosity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Carmel. I thought we would start with a few minutes of quiet reflection. I realize that all of you, or at least most of you, are familiar with meditation practice, so I don't need to say a great deal. But let's just pause in whatever thoughts were running through our minds, whatever emotions. Someone says they can't hear. Can you hear me, Carmel?
I can hear you. Shir'el is our technical support.
Yes, I can hear you as well.
Okay. So I'd like to open this meeting with a few minutes of quiet reflection. No doubt you have different practices. Whatever practice you're familiar with that enables you just to come to rest, to take a little bit of distance from the thoughts and the emotions that may be running through you, and just to find within yourself, maybe deeper in your body, in your solar plexus or in your Dantian, just a groundedness. Not a groundedness in which you cancel out the thoughts and the feelings, but a groundedness that allows you to be with them in a more stable, in a more existentially real way. So for many of us, we'll probably begin by coming back to our breathing and to feel our breathing as it moves through us like a tide of life, coming and going, breath after breath, and just coming to rest, coming to settle in that tidal rhythm of life, essentially. Of being alive, being conscious, but being still, being balanced, being collected. If you find your mind is wandering away, then gently come back to your own breathing. And remember that you're not alone in this meditation, that there are many of us together trying to be still. So allow yourself to feel the community that is sustaining this mindful attention right now. Thank you. I think Eran is now going to say a few words.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Stephen. I first want to say just one technical thing that I was asked to say by Tovana's team, and it's a chance to thank Tovana and Toda'a Bria team, Reut and Aner and Shirel and Michal, for organizing and supporting this meeting and others. And what they would ask all of us to know, sometimes there are interruptions in these Zooms. If it happens, just after a while, few seconds, when you can, use the same link and go, please come to the same room. I want to join Carmel, who initiate very much, Carmel, for that. With the deep gratitude to you, Stephen. It's terrible circumstances to meet, but still, I'm happy to meet you. I didn't see you for quite a long years. You are a major teacher for me and a friend. And the deep gratitude for your willingness to be with us in these times. Because I know you a bit, I want to say a few words that will be kind of background. I don't know how many of us here know, but you are one of the first teachers that came to Israel to what after became to be Tovana. As far as I know, that's what before even I was involved, I think it was in 91 that you visited here. You gave a retreat in Klil, and it is said that at this time there was a war, and you were sitting there in the meditation, in the small meditation hall in Klil, and once in a while you heard boom. I want to tell you that Klil, that I know that you are familiar with, which is the village where I live in northern Israel, me and Stephen Fodor, which is one of its founders, Carmel lived there for a while, doesn't look the same these days. It's not just that it became a bit bigger, but what happened like recently, the population is not there. In the village, which is not surrounded by fences, or there are now huge rocks at the entrance. There are guards. I found myself never in my life I was a guard of anything, part of the community, and guard there. And it was just after we came back there. Most of the people are not there even now. And also me and my family, just at the beginning, after all of the news of what happened in the South, which brought a huge terror in us. Terror of you were one of those who guided me so deeply to reflect and becoming more friendly to the understanding of our, but this was something of completely different level. As Stephen Jenkinson put it a few days ago, the distinction between the fear of dying and the fear of being murdered or being slaughtered. And it's something that is present in our hearts and minds. Just yesterday, Carmel and myself were talking in the phone, thinking together about the meeting today, and just in the middle, Carmel was sounded weird. And then she told me, Elan, I need to stop the call for a while. This is the presence for the people listening to us right now. With that, I want also to mention that since the last time you've been here in Endor, but I myself just now. And then Endor for the last couple of years is not the same. Tovana rented the facility and it's now like a meditation center 365 days a year, or we thought it's going to be like that. Till 3 weeks ago, we finished a retreat and we didn't continue. About 50 people here are people that from the north of Israel. 150,000 people in Israel left their homes by command of the army. Many others left their home because they chose so. So here, a small gesture that we can do for community, for the society, is allowing people to be here. And beside that, there are the coordinators who lives here. And just now, there came for the weekend some people from the Sangha who wanted to be together in this ground in these days, and you might see them in one of the windows. I think it said Segev. You're going to see the many people, and they're sitting here in Endor, came to be in Dharma environment to find refuge in these days. And thank you again for being with us and allowing us to have a kind of a refuge together with you for this time, which going to be for about 1 hour. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Eran. I first need to...
Stephen, we don't see your picture now.
Okay, I'm looking at a text. That's the reason. I didn't realize this would happen. If it's okay, I will just give my my reflections without your seeing me, and then I'll reappear.
Definitely.
Okay. Eran, thank you very much indeed. And thank you for reminding me of my first experience in Israel many years ago at Klil, where we did witness a short conflict across the border with Lebanon. But I have to acknowledge that I feel very powerless as a speaker here. I cannot possibly imagine what you are going through in the wake of the atrocities that were inflicted upon your people, your communities, maybe some of you with friends, maybe family, who suffered these brutal attacks. I've lived a life of great privilege and safety in Western Europe, and I've never been exposed to the kinds of threats that you have been subjected to in the last 3 weeks. So forgive me if I say anything that is insensitive to your plight. I will do my best to bear in mind, as best I can, how you must be feeling in these times. But I'd like to start by acknowledging how it's tragedy and suffering of this order that very often is what serves as the most powerful test for our practice of the Dharma. It's very easy to be a good Buddhist or a good Christian or a good Jew or a good Muslim when your practice is not put to the test. If you live in a situation of privilege and comfort, it's relatively easy to sustain a practice, to study spiritual and religious philosophies without ever really being existentially challenged. For many years, I was a Tibetan Buddhist monk, and I remember clearly conversations I had with my Tibetan teachers and friends about what happened in Lhasa, the capital of Tibet, in 1959, where the Chinese military opened fire on Tibetans who were demonstrating against the imposition of Chinese rule. And I remember one Geshe that I was living with at the time said how from one day to the next, fellow monks, fellow practitioners that he thought of as very, very committed and strong people in their practice reacted in completely different ways. Some immediately faced the challenge by fleeing across the mountains to the safety of India. Others felt that their world had been destroyed or was going to be destroyed, and they took their own lives. But 24 hours earlier, he would have been unable to predict who amongst his friends would have reacted in one way and who amongst his friends would have reacted in the other way. When your practice is put to this kind of test, in a way, it reveals the extent to which the Dharma has taken root in your mind, in your heart, in your body, and to what extent it has been just a consolatory set of beliefs and values and ideals that has not really taken hold in the depths of your being. When I think of your situation now, I think of examples of Buddhist teachers that I've known and how they, not so much in terms of what they've said, but in terms of how they have lived. I've been around the Dalai Lama now for more than 50 years, and he has stood out for me as someone who has been subjected to enormous calamity and crisis and violence. And he stands for me, and perhaps for many of you as well, not just as a Buddhist teacher, but as someone whose life is somehow expressing what he stands for in a very real, in a very humble, in a very honest, and in a very wise and kind way. Another example is Thich Nhat Hanh, who died recently, again, whom I had been in contact with for many, many years. And he too was forged in a way, his practice was forged by the conflict in Vietnam between the communist North and the capitalist or democratic South. And he sought to find a middle way, to not get caught up in the rivalries and disputes between the two sides, but to find a voice that spoke from the middle. And he often expressed this as trying to be a voice for those without a voice, trying to be a voice for the ordinary Vietnamese people who were subject to bombardments and to raids and whose voice was not really heard. He too, for me, is someone who stands as an exemplary figure, not so much through what he says, but more through who he was. Both of these men were not idealists. They were not thinking in simple binary terms, but both understood the complexity of the moral situation in which they found themselves. They resisted the temptation to take sides. They, with the Dalai Lama, he always expressed great concern for the Chinese, despite the fact that they were destroying his culture, his people, his country. So it's these figures, I feel, who can be a light in this darkness that we are currently all going through. I'd like to read to you a text that comes not from the Buddhist tradition, but comes from the playwright of ancient Greece called Aeschylus. It's in his play Agamemnon, which is part of the Orestia trilogy. And it was first performed in about 460 before the Common Era. He starts by speaking of Zeus, which we can take generally to mean God. Zeus puts us on the road to mindfulness. Zeus decrees that we learn by suffering. In the heart, there is no sleep. There drips instead pain that remembers wounds. And to unwilling minds, wisdom arises. For me, these lines echo the logic of the practice of the Dharma. How Zeus, whether we take Zeus as meaning God or nature, or simply the conditionality of life itself, how that impacts our minds and senses moment to moment, sweeping us along on the current of life. Yet this same current of life unfolds in a way that enables us to be mindful of it, to have the capacity to notice, to reflect on, and to embrace suffering, however difficult, perhaps however impossible that might feel to many of us now. But this path, this practice, enables us to comprehend the human situation for all of its beauty, for all of its horror, in such a way that wisdom may finally dawn. Robert F. Kennedy, the younger brother of the assassinated president, quoted this very verse to an audience of mainly African Americans on the day that Martin Luther King was murdered in April 1968. Kennedy was a Catholic. Martin Luther King was a Baptist minister. And instead of calling upon the biblical tradition, he called upon a quotation from a pagan, Aeschylus, a Greek playwright, a contemporary of the Buddha. And he concluded his brief sermon on that occasion with another citation from the American classicist Edith Hamilton. Let us dedicate ourselves to what the Greeks wrote so many years ago, to tame the savageness of man and make gentle the life of this world. To tame the savageness of man and make gentle the life of this world. 2 months later, Robert Kennedy was assassinated. And both the Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh have also failed in many ways to realize their goals. The Dalai Lama has said recently that despite all of his efforts, he has achieved nothing for the people of Tibet. Thich Nhat Hanh suffered years and years of exile and finally was able to die in his country, but not having achieved the vision that he saw for Vietnam. But as a result, they grew in the moral stature of the persons they came to be. The Dalai Lama was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Thich Nhat Hanh was nominated for it by Martin Luther King. And it is this kind of moral and ethical integrity that I feel stands as a sterling and uplifting example for all of us who face similar threats and sufferings personally and collectively. Their standing is not calculated according to whether they succeeded or failed in their respective endeavors. Their standing is because of the stance that they lived in their lives. If we go back to the Buddha, we find in one of the most moving and perhaps best known passages how, as he too is close to his own death, he presents his Dharma as an island, as a refuge. And not just the Dharma, but also the self, that the self and the Dharma become an island and a refuge. And by that, I understand that each of us has the capacity to integrate the Dharma into our lives in such a way that we, each of us, finds within a space of peace, a space of clarity, a space of understanding, but not as a way in which we can then disengage from life, disengage from suffering, but in such a way that the Dharma and the Dharma as integrated into our specific individuality becomes a ground and a source from which to respond to suffering wisely and compassionately. And in doing so, we seek to create and sustain this non-reactive space, a space that we touch in meditation, but crucially, a space that allows us the clarity and the freedom to respond to our situation in life that is not determined by our greed, by our hatred, by our fear, by our opinionatedness, such that we can embrace, comprehend what's going on, we can let go of what entangles us in fear and greed, that we can find moments in life in which we stop and are still and are open in such a way that we have a capacity to respond appropriately. And finally, I'd like to cite a text that comes from the Tibetan tradition. It's one of the mind training verses, which is something I repeat to myself again and again and again. And it runs, "Please bless me to transform negative circumstances into the path, to take whatever is difficult and painful and seems to completely overwhelm and obstruct us at times, and to recognize within that there is the possibility through practice, through determination, to turn that circumstance into the path of awakening itself. So that's where I would like to conclude. I hope what I've been saying has been of value, that it has afforded you perhaps a slightly different perspective from which to reflect on your situation. And in the time that remains for us, the next half an hour or so, I'd be very happy to respond as best I can to whatever questions that you may have. And the moderator will read your questions as they appear in the chat, and then I will do my best to respond in an appropriate way. But I see my presence amongst you as much as my being a listener. I want to learn from you. I don't have the answers, but I might be able to help you frame the questions in a way that might be helpful. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
Thank you, Stephen. I would just say I saw a question. Yeah, there will be a recording and there will be a link in Tovana's site. And normally, as many of you know, we do not record the questions to enable people their privacy. This time, that's part of the reason that, Stephen, we will choose questions from the chat. Please write your questions in the chat, and with the recording, we'll go on.
I noticed that one of the chats said, please, could you send the texts? I'm very happy to do that. I'll send them to Carmel and Eran when we finish. The questions are passing very rapidly in front of me. Eran, could you maybe single out one or two?
Where is that line between embedding the Dharma and using as a spiritual bypass?
Well, so the question is about the difference between embedding the Dharma in your life and using the Dharma as a spiritual bypass. This, I think, very much refers back to the example I gave of the Tibetan monks. Some of them had embedded the Dharma and they lived from it, even in the crisis. Others, perhaps, had used it as a spiritual bypass. The word I used was as a consolation. I think we often use religion, and I think often quite legitimately, as a way to console us, as a way to give us a sense of hope, a sense of possibility. But however important that might be, if it doesn't take root within us, it will be relatively ineffective, perhaps, particularly at times like the one we're going through now. And it could well be that, as I suggested, that this is the test of the practice, that it's perhaps only in times like this that we can know for ourselves whether our practice is embedded within us or whether it has simply been a way to cope, a way to, as it were, feel better about ourselves and our lives, but without it really taking hold. Aeschylus, the Greek playwright that I mentioned, he also says something very similar. He says, when people watch his tragic plays, they groan along with the misery, but the pain of the suffering fails to bite into their hearts. This is a similar idea. And it's here, I think, that we can see how such a circumstance as this, however awful it is, gives us the opportunity to engage with that experience we're going through in such a way that it really bites, in such a way that it really engages with our practice. But I think that's all I can say to that. It's for each of us to perhaps re-evaluate our practice of the Dharma, not in terms of what we've heard about it or what great teachers have told us, but in terms of what difference does it really make now? That's in a way all that matters at some level. So finding an opportunity to deepen, finding an opportunity to touch into dimensions of our life that we perhaps have not yet accessed before.
Well, I would like to bring some of the questions, especially the one in Hebrew. And one of them was the sadness, the sadness. And the embarrassment about sharing peace texts. For example, I have a shirt with a peace sign on the back, and I'm not wearing it now. And then the question in Hebrew, very heart touching, what can one rely on in a time when we are displaced from our physical home, displaced from our family, displaced from our community? So if you could address the sadness, the embarrassment about peacemaking, and the how to cope with being displaced.
Well, again, having lived such a privileged life, I've never been displaced. And I find it quite difficult to imagine what that would feel like. You know, I've lived every day of my life knowing that I will have enough on the table to eat, that I will not be threatened by physical violence, or very unlikely to be so. I've lived all of my life knowing that if anything, you know, bad happens to me, my embassy will fly me back to England or wherever it is. I've always had in the background of my awareness the sense that I'm safe. And I know that many of you are going through experiences now in which you don't feel safe, and not just safe temporarily, but safe as a member of your whole society doesn't feel safe. Your community doesn't feel safe. You are exiled. And of course, this is something that the Jewish people have a long history with, the experience of exile, be it in Babylon, be it in Egypt. Your texts are so powerfully expressing the tragedy of being exiled, of being displaced. And I wonder whether the answer to these questions doesn't lie deep in your own tradition here, whether or not you are practicing Judaism. But I think the stories that have kept your community and your people for so many centuries with such integrity, I feel somehow, in a way, unable to say more than your own tradition already carries with it, that has had such an impact on the whole of Western civilization. And again, my examples are more recent, with the Dalai Lama, with Thich Nhat Hanh, and the sadness that you speak of. Perhaps it's even deeper than the sort of general sadness that I would understand. I feel the first thing is really to be able to simply acknowledge that sadness, to be able to say yes to that sadness, to be able to sit with that sadness, to not feel that this sadness is unpleasant and I don't like it and I'd like to find a way to get rid of it. That I feel is in a way ignoring the message of that sadness. To be able to really plumb the depths of how you feel in this situation. And notice how the mind will react against that. We would much rather find some kind of ready-made solution in Buddhism, for example. But I feel that times like this, the ready-made solutions of Buddhists and all religions and philosophies somehow might seem to fail us, that we need something more than those teachings can offer at such times. So again, embrace and open yourself to these feelings and not to feel guilty about them, like the feelings that Carmel mentioned about not wanting to, you know, display a wish for peace, for example. Where is that feeling? In what is it rooted? To what extent has your love of peace been perhaps also a form of spiritual bypass, a form of consolation, a form of feeling that you're on the side of the good guys, the nice people? Go deeper than that. Ask yourself, you know, where does peace reside? Not just in the world, but deep down in yourselves. Is it possible to really experience peace in a world of such incredible conflict? And not just specifically in Israel right now, but we live in a conflicted community of human beings and animals and plants and planets and everything. Go to the depths. Go deep down. Be open-minded about that. Don't have expectations of what you might find. I think that's all I can say.
Steven?
Yes.
Yeah.
Aaron.
You've mentioned the incompetence of ready-made Buddhist or other religion solutions. And I want to read two questions, I think, to each other, and maybe add something from my own. One question is asking you to talk about the difference between violence and self-protection. The other one is saying, to the best of my knowledge, the Dalai Lama was not a pacifist. Can I acknowledge the plight of the other side, but still acknowledge that I have to support fighting of what I hold as a tragic fight is? And I want to share a kind of a moral dilemma that I found in myself. For many years, practicing and reflecting about Sila, the value of not taking life seemed so clear and vivid in me. And finding myself, especially after what happened in the south of Israel, when kind of survival mode arose in me and thoughts with fear in them, what will I do in a solution when someone is coming with a rifle to my home and I'm with my kids. And realizing that if I will be capable of, I would take his life. And it was very, very shaking understanding for me. And it's related to these questions about it. It was kind of easy for me. I felt like, say, for my knees, okay, I'm not going to be a soldier or a guard, or I'm not do anything that might take myself into that situation. In front of the face, it's bringing questions.
As you speak, a couple of things come to mind. I lived in Switzerland for many years, a country renowned for being neutral, for being peaceful. But I soon discovered that every man, every male citizen of Switzerland has in his house a rifle, ammunition, and a military uniform, including with no exceptions. I have a close friend who was the most gentle person I can imagine. And he too had a rifle, an ammunition, and a helmet in his cupboard in his bedroom. And I asked him once, Martin, it was his name, you know, how do you live with that? How do you live with the fact that you are practicing Buddhism? You're going to be before that, he was going to be a Christian minister. How can you deal with this? How can you possibly imagine ever using these weapons? And he said, if enemy soldiers came to my village and threatened my wife and my kids, I would shoot them. He said, it would probably drive me insane, but I would do it. I'm in South Korea right now. And I lived in a Korean monastery for many years back in the 1980s. And one of the things that again shocked me was that even sometimes halfway through a meditation retreat, the monks would leave the meditation hall, they would put on military fatigues, and they would go out on military training for the day, regularly. The monks in Korea are exceptional amongst the Buddhist monks worldwide in that they see they have a duty to defend their country against aggression. It was Korean monastic militias who in the late 16th century turned the tide against a Japanese invasion. And since then, the monks have taken not a pacifist stance, but a sense of duty to their nation to defend it when the time comes. There are some monks who refuse to do this, and the only way they can get out of the army is by taking an axe and chopping off their fingers so they can't fire a gun. This troubled me enormously. But the more I've come to think about it, the more I realize that there is an integrity and a, in a sense, a realism involved in this particular stance. I also remember after the 9/11 attacks in New York, I wrote a piece for Tricycle magazine at that time. And in that essay, for the first time, I began to recognize that violence is not just an optional extra when it comes to the preservation of a nation or a nation state, but that the nation state is premised upon the government's willingness to use violence to protect the freedoms that that state grants its citizens. That again, we can live as nice, peaceful Buddhists, but we're only able to live as nice, peaceful Buddhists because we are finally protected by a state that is willing to use violence to protect our freedoms. We need, I think, to recognize that violence is built into the structure of the state itself. It's built into the very systemic conditions that provide us with the freedoms and the liberties that we enjoy. And I wonder sometimes whether we need to make a difference between violence and cruelty. I feel that violence is inevitable. It's unavoidable. But cruelty is not. Cruelty strikes me as what is really the one thing that cannot be justified, that cannot be forgiven, that has no justification at all. What happened in the south of Israel was an example of extreme cruelty. It's not a problem of violence. It's the willingness of certain people and groups to inflict cruelty on those who are not in any sense able to defend themselves, who have done no wrong. It's unprovoked. It's the cruel. So it's an ahimsa, the Indian word that's usually translated as non-violence. In fact, it strikes me that it would be better to translate as non-cruelty. Not being cruel to others is the moral that I can hold to, that I can live, seek to live by. Whereas non-violence, I find, is ambiguous, in fact. So that would be my response to that. Was there another? I think there was another point you made as well, but I can't remember what it was. Let's leave that one there, unless you would like to come back on that, Aaron.
Well, I would say it was a very appropriate and insightful and meaningful response. Thank you.
Maybe I can bring some of the more of the questions that came up in Hebrew. And thank you for all you've said until now. One of the questions is about so many people feel a need for revenge, and how do we respond? Some people want to to react, to destroy, and including the civilians that the Hamas is holding, is using as a human shield. And how do we deal with the fact that our response brings with it so much hatred and anger and rage? And how do we deal with the anger and the rage? I know these are the questions. Maybe I can add a question of my own.
Yes.
Because it's all about, for me, the essence of Dharma is the opening of the heart and the qualities of the loving kindness, the friendliness, the compassion, the appreciation, and the stability, the equanimity, the ability to remain centered somehow. So maybe you could also address those and how they might be of help in this situation.
I think much of what I'm going to say is something that you already know. I think in terms of my practice, and again, I can only speak from my relatively privileged experience. The first step has to be, I feel, to be able to acknowledge these feelings and to be able to acknowledge these emotions, and not just in a sort of a, you know, just noting them as one might in Vipassana sometimes. Oh, there's anger, there's rage. No, it requires more than just noting these things. It requires that we open ourselves to the reality of such emotions that are surging within us. And we know too that when we're in the grip of a powerful emotion, it's not something we can easily control. It's something we can perhaps allow a space in which that emotion is allowed to come forth. What we don't want to do as Buddhists, or I think even as human beings, is to pretend that they're not really happening. That's really just another strategy of repression, of denial. And I think the denial of these feelings, because I meditate on metta every day, and then I start feeling rage and revenge, I'm likely to think, well, that's not really me. Now, this is something that's, you know, inappropriate. This is something that has to be abandoned, is a word that is often used in Buddhist discourse. I think abandoning is a little bit too strong a word on the one hand, and an inappropriate on the other. I don't know whether these things can just be abandoned. I'm not sure they can just be let go of either. They somehow need to be allowed the space to be. The causes and conditions of life have led to these powerful feelings and emotions, and they need to be honored. They're not, by definition, evil and wrong. They are simply how your organism is understandably responding to the conditions in which you find yourselves now. But that does not mean that you thereby have to act upon, that you need to believe the narrative that goes along with such emotions. In other words, it's really a question more of letting them be, letting them play themselves out, letting them find, you know, that release, as it were, within one. But at the same time, to recognize that in this non-reactive space that's acknowledging that, there is also the possibility of freedom, the freedom not to rush out with a knife and stab someone. We need to somehow differentiate what is merely an understandable but essentially reactive response that over which we, in a way, are unable to exercise any moral judgment. And to distinguish between emotions of rage and so forth, that at times may be appropriate responses to the situation. To me, the middle way is really a practice of making that judgment. What is appropriate? What is inappropriate? And that is the moral, ethical starting point. So it's not repressing these feelings, but nor is it allowing them total free play, in which I just get pushed along, often, you know, in concert with others who feel the same way. At least that is how I can imagine the situation that many of you must be feeling at the moment. How you deal with that, I'm afraid, is really your practice. I can only present a framework. But it's not easy. It's not easy at all. It must be devastatingly difficult, given the values that would lead you to join a group like Tovana.
There is the pain. It is horribly painful. Just painful. Yeah. Thank you. I think we have time for Eran, maybe one more round.
ערן, לא שומעים אותך.
עכשיו שומעים?
כן.
There are a few questions of people who are sharing that they find themselves, take themselves to places with a lot of suffering, to hospitals, to people who evacuated their homes, to people out under severe trauma from the south. And they're saying that when they are active and there, they mostly find a center, but then go back home, they're just collapsing. They feel a tide of compassion and pain that they cannot hold. And the question is if you can say anything about it.
I can say what, you know, limited, perhaps. Again, I feel that in extreme situations, we are very likely going to have extreme reactions. If there's enormous suffering of people in hospitals displaced, it's quite natural that we seek to do whatever we can to alleviate that suffering and pain, to keep company with those who are suffering more than we are. But that can also lead us to burnout. However selfish it might seem at one level, we have to take care of ourselves. Otherwise, we can quickly become useless. We can't really deal with others effectively anymore, and we dig ourselves deeper and deeper into a hole of our own making. Again, this cannot be easy, and I feel in a sense embarrassed to say this almost, but again, I think this middle way is acknowledging the need both to care for others and to care for oneself. I go back to my Tibetan tradition. The Buddha is defined in Tibetan philosophy, or Buddhahood is defined as a state of being in which one fulfills the purpose of others and one fulfills the purpose of oneself. It's not either or. We find this also in the Pali text as well, the need to not deny oneself to such a point that one ceases to acknowledge one's own limitations, to acknowledge one's own needs, to have the capacity to rest, to have the capacity to know when you've, in a sense, pushed yourself too far, the capacity to step back. On a smaller scale, anyone who works in healthcare as a therapist will know what I'm talking about here. But obviously this is now magnified into a social, national crisis where these tiny examples may not, you know, be particularly borne in mind anymore. But I think the same principle must hold true. We need to care for ourselves if we are to care for others in these situations.
I notice a question here, very basic. Sometimes there are conditions that we cannot sit and meditate. How do we practice when we cannot do, when we cannot sustain sitting on the cushion?
Well, I think this, again, this is a good example of our practice being put to the test. And again, this might raise the question is our practice just, you know, essentially about sitting on a cushion and being quiet and still? This, I think, is one of the things that's attracted people all over the West to Buddhism, is because it gives us something to do rather than something just to believe. And that something to do is very often then reduced to performing a certain spiritual exercise every day. Let's call it meditation. But perhaps what we're being called upon in our situation now is to extend and to enlarge what we mean by this word practice. Practice, one word for practice in the early Buddhist tradition is that of bhavana, which is often translated as meditation, but really what it means is cultivation. It's bringing something into being. And the whole of the Eightfold Path, from the way we perceive the world, the way we think, the way we speak, the way we act, these are all practices. I think it's too narrow to think of practice just as performing a specific meditative exercise every now and again. And perhaps that exposes a certain weakness in this model of the Vipassana world. Too much emphasis is placed on meditation as what is either equivalent to practice or somehow lies at the core of the practice. I'm a writer. I also dabble in art. And I see both of these activities as just as much part of my practice as I do my daily meditation. I think if you're working in the helping professions, if you're a therapist or a doctor, your practice is not what you do at home. Your practice is how you manifest your care in your relationships, in your work, with your loved ones. I think we need to reconsider what we mean by practice. And does that necessarily only refer to the exercises that we're taught? This is an opportunity perhaps to magnify the very concept of practice itself. It's 4:15 here in South Korea, at the end of the day, or getting towards the end of the day. I'd just like to thank all of you for having spent this hour or more together. I hope that what we've discussed, maybe some of the things I said have been helpful in some way or another. And I realize, of course, for you, you know, this is just one day out of many that have gone before, and probably many that will continue into the weeks and months ahead, that is a complete unknown. And that I feel this for myself in following your story through the news media, but for those of you on the ground, there must be this enormous sense of what the future is going to bring. And that must be extraordinarily challenging, I suspect. And I can only wish you the very best in however you are able to cope with these situations, drawing upon Buddhism, but also drawing upon your own traditions, drawing upon other schools of thought, Greek playwrights, or whatever it is that is able to speak to you at this time of great turmoil and suffering and distress. So please keep well. And thanks to everyone at Tor Vinah who has made this meeting possible. And as promised, I will send an email with those quotations from Aeschylus that Tor Vinah can put on their website or however they would distribute them. And again, anything that I could do to be of any help, however little that might be, please do not hesitate to consider calling upon me again. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Stephen, thank you. Thank you so much for that. It's so touching and it's so meaningful. Your presence with us in these times, your meaningful and wise words and reflections and humbleness. I want to remind us all that we use in a double in ambiguity the word safe zone in these days. Safe zone is also our shelters when we go under our sirens. And we call these meetings together safe zones that remind us the Dharma as a realm. And I want also to, with you, to thank all the dear people from Tovana, the people that work for Tovana and the volunteers that enable Tovana to still keep offering these things. And the invitation for whoever wants to support this activity, there is the possibility to give Dana. Maybe Reut will copy the link, or it can be also checked in their website. Thank you so much, all. Thank you, Stephen. Thank you,
Dana.
Tonya.
Whatever Dana comes, it goes to Tovana.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to leave you now. Thank you, Aaron. Thank you, Carmel. Thank you, Ruit. Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.